Hello and welcome once again to St Albans and District Talking News, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the News Extra edition for the 7 days beginning Saturday, the 4th of October, 2025. My name is Ian. This week I'm editing and producing this programme. Don't worry, I'm just standing in for Steve Henrys, who's away. Steve will be back with News Extra in November. This edition will once again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online, and it's currently available if you're using a mobile device on the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Amongst other items, this edition has, as usual, on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings. Once again, we'll be listening to the latest edition of In Concert from David Ireson and Jill Burridge. There will also be the list of audio-described programmes on television, courtesy of the Wharfedale Talking News. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdates in the coming week. Continuing my trawl through my favourite singers and musicians, you just heard True Companion by Donald Fagan. More about him later. But first, this week's news roundup, read by Leslie, Marion, Michelle and Caroline.
Hello, I'm Caroline. A free exhibition and zine featuring untold stories from Hertfordshire Black heritage is set to open in St Albans. Our stories, Tracing Black Histories in Hertfordshire, launches in St Albans Museum and Gallery today, October the 2nd, and is described as a giant size record of the county's black history. The exhibition includes artworks and life-size zine installation inspired by research from the museum's Black History Research Group. Zines have historically been used by marginalised groups to share counter-narratives and self-expression through articles, poems, plays and illustrations. The BHRG's zine draws on 4 years of research by 30 volunteers, highlighting overlooked aspects of St Albans and Hertfordshire's black history, spanning 2,000 years from Roman Verulamium to the present. It covers the harsh realities of slavery, exclusion and persecution, alongside stories of resilience, entrepreneurship and family life. Aisha Adi, that's the chair of BHRG and co-curator of the exhibition, said, "Our stories exhibition and publication of an A5 zine is the first time a project of this kind has been taken place in St Albans. The history of black people in this country is often falsely portrayed or ignored, and it's important to document this history in a way that is honest and accessible. The exhibition and zine seek to do this with a focus on the history of black people in Hertfordshire. The exhibition features artwork by black artists, including London-based award winner Janavi Innes, who said, "This project is a fantastic opportunity to engage people with new stories that empower black communities in St Albans, Hertfordshire and across the wider UK. Visitors can also explore soundscapes, poetry readings and oral histories from the Windrush generation, alongside historical zines, magazines and objects." Farhana Begum, Arts, Tourism, Heritage and Culture Manager at St Albans City and District Council, said, "We're hoping to open up important conversations across our community. The museum will also host events, including a family cook-along and a mindful collage workshop. Our stories, Tracing Black Histories in Hertfordshire, runs until November the 2nd at St Albans Museum and Gallery in the Assembly Room. Entry is free."
Hello, I'm Michelle. Improvements to cemeteries worth £730,000 are now underway across the district. The works are part of a series of projects the council is undertaking at its three cemeteries, with the other two located at Hatfield Road and London Road in St Albans. The installation of a garden of rest at Westfield Road Cemetery in Harpenden has been made a priority in the programme of upgrades. This work will include the refurbishment of the existing memorial wall and a new area for the scattering of ashes. St Albans City and District Council Cemeteries team is in contact with residents who want to lay the ashes of loved ones to rest at the site and have set up a waiting list. Councillor Helen Campbell, Chair of the Public Realm Committee, inspected the Westfield Road Cemetery and said, "I am pleased with the progress that is being made to ensure our cemeteries are kept to an extremely high standard for the benefit of our residents. We decided last year that multiple improvements were necessary for the needs of our diverse communities in the future, and we are now well underway in implementing our proposals. These include work that will allow us to offer eco-friendly medal burials, an increasingly popular choice, and a wider range of memorials for a loved one. Our various projects will also enhance the overall presentation of the cemeteries and maintain them as a quiet place for reflection and remembrance." An update on the works was given to the Public Realm Committee at its September meeting. Councillors were also told of the progress being made at London Road, where surveys are being undertaken to prepare for its new Garden of Rest. Preparatory work is also underway to create a new Muslim burial area, which may include vaults or chambers. At Hatfield Road, new seeds sown this year should create an attractive wildflower area to enhance the Green Meadow burial area over the next 2 years. In an area of the cemetery adjacent to the Albany Way, a woodland walk is being developed. Alternative memorials, including bird and bat boxes, are to be made available to commemorate loved ones. In addition, the cemetery team is currently sourcing suppliers for new benches and litter bins for all three sites.
Hello, I'm Marion, and the first article I'm going to read is "Man Jailed Over £7,700 Cosmetics Theft." A thief has been jailed after stealing more than £7,700 worth of cosmetics from a London Colney shop. Daniel McDonough of Peacock Court, Hemel Hempstead, was sentenced to 26 weeks in prison at St Albans Magistrates Court on September the 25th. The court heard that on April the 10th, 2024, McDonough stole cosmetics to the value of £7,761 belonging to Boots in London Colney. He pleaded not guilty to the offence in March. The 21-year-old was imprisoned due to the offences being so serious that only a custodial sentence can be justified. According to documents on court's desk, the reason for McDonough's custody was because the defendant demonstrated a flagrant disregard for people and their property. Neighbourhood Sergeant Hannah McLaughlin added, "We work closely with the shops in London Colney to help prevent and catch shoplifters. McDonough was caught on CCTV concealing the cosmetics under his jacket and in his pockets. The magistrate took into account his previous shoplifting offending, which included a penalty of 12 months unpaid work in June this year and a 5-week suspended sentence in January this year. I hope this sentence deters other opportunist thieves from stealing from our local stores. The impact of shoplifting affects us all."
Hello, my name is Leslie, and my first article is headed, "The Pudding Stop Closes All Shops in Hertfordshire." Popular Hertfordshire-based bakery, The Pudding Stop, has announced the shock closure of its branches across the county. After 14 years of business, The Pudding Stop announced with a heavy heart that it would be closing stores until further notice on September 29th. Brainchild of former Great British Bake Off contestant Johnny Shepherd, the bakery operated locations in St Albans, Harpenden, Radlett and Redbourne. Its closure was announced via a Facebook post that read, It's no secret that the past few years have brought significant challenges, and throughout that time, we've worked tirelessly to keep the Pudding Stop going. It is with a heavy heart that we have made the difficult decision to close the business, the Post added. As of this morning, all locations will remain closed until further notice. Thank you for your support and loyalty. It has meant the world to us. The Pudding Stop began in 2011 through the Pudmobile outside St Albans City Station. Thanks to hundreds of commuters who believed in the brand, the first shop was opened 2 years later. It was well known for offering an array of handmade bakes, including donuts, pastries and brownies, in addition to handcrafted coffee. The Pudding Stop has been approached for further comment. The Pudding Stop has published a further statement concerning its employees and extended its gratitude for the community's messages of support. A follow-up post read, "Sadly, this means that we have 30 employees now looking for a new job. Some have been with us for over 10 years. It is a devastating situation to be in. If you run a restaurant, a cafe, a deli, a bakery, or any other local business and you're looking for staff, I have a list of the best people you could ever employ. Bakers, baristas, front of house, delivery drivers, and more. Please contact me, johnny@thepuddingstop.com, and I'll put you in touch."
The St Albans MP is incredibly sad to see two long-standing St Albans businesses close their doors. On Monday, St Albans-born bakery The Pudding Shop confirmed that it has shut its Hertfordshire shops. The announcement was not long after the closure of Laws and Sons Butchers, which ceased trading from Catherine Street on September the 27th. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper took to Facebook, voicing her concerns for businesses in the area. "So incredibly sad that two fantastic St Albans businesses, The Pudding Shop and Laws and Sons Butchers, have had to close their doors," she said. "They will be a loss to our community and our city centre. These closures are yet another indicator of how much high street businesses in St Albans and nationwide are struggling at the moment," the MP added. "Whether it's higher food and energy costs, reduced footfall, or the government's growth-crushing jobs tax, businesses are under immense pressure. Family butchers Laws and Sons shut last weekend after more than 20 years operating in the city centre. Signage in the shop windows read, "Thank you for your support over the years. We will miss you."
St Albans independent businesses are set to launch a new shop and park scheme that gives back to shoppers when they park for a minimum of 4 hours in the city centre. All customers have to do is show evidence of their parking ticket, and participating businesses will offer a discount at the till. The shop and park idea is launching in time for the pre-Christmas period, offering both an incentive to shop in St Albans and a thank you for continued support of businesses. Vikas Nuwala, owner of participating business Tikka Nation, said, "This scheme is powered by local businesses. We want to give our customers a very clear message that we value them. We recognise that at times are difficult financially, and with the festive season fast approaching, our message is that customers are welcome in St Albans and we have much to offer. We hope this idea proves mutually beneficial to everyone. Every business involved will display a shop and park sticker or poster to indicate they offer a discount. They are to decide their own level of discount per the amount of spend and display their offer in their premises. The common factor is that customers must evidence they are parked a minimum of 4 hours. Businesses intend the discount will help towards their customers' parking. Four business representatives are heading up the scheme on behalf of the independent community: Lee James of Shaking Cow, High Street Sean Hughes of The Boot, Marketplace, and Dylan's. George Street Vickers Narala of Tikka Nation, Waxhouse Gate Dan Leek of Bishop's Cave, Hollywell Hill. The scheme starts on Tuesday, September the 30th, 2025, and will run to Saturday, January the 31st, 2026. Upon its conclusion, the initiative will be reviewed and businesses can then decide to extend, alter or not, depending on feedback from peers and customers. St Albans City Centre BID is supporting the businesses deliver their new scheme. Vivian Cannon, BID manager, said, "BID's role here is to help our local businesses. Our support is given by promoting the scheme on their behalf, helping to get the scheme launched and its ongoing promotion. St Albans customers are incredibly fortunate to have such a proactive business community."
Baker is named among the best in Hertfordshire. Muddy Stilettos has included a pair of St Albans bakeries in a new list of the best in Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire. The Lifestyle publication released its section of 8 Hearts and Beds Bakeries We Love to mark the new series of the Great British Bake Off, which started this month. Redbornbury Watermill and Bakery was among Muddy Stilettos' list, with praise heaped on the historic location. The article says, "Enjoy a slice of history with your freshly baked bun or baguette at Redbornbury Watermill and Bakery. Dating back to the 16th century, this working watermill still produces a range of stone-ground organic flours, which are then transformed into utterly delicious breads in the bakery." Also featured in the list is the award-winning Pro Artisan Bakery for its locations in Ware and St Albans. Lavishing the business with praise, the publication says, "Husband and wife team, James and Joanne, started making sourdough when Joanne realised she had a gluten intolerance and heard that sourdough could be a good alternative, being easier to digest, more nutritious than shop-bought alternatives and gut-friendly too. Now with 2 stores, you'll find plenty of sourdough, plus focaccia, croissant, donuts, sandwiches and other sweet treats, all freshly baked and ready to delight," Muddy Stilettos added.
Batchwood Hall, 6 offers received to lease St Albans site. 6 offers have been received by St Albans City and District Council to take on a lease at Batchwood Hall, it has been revealed. The historic building was put back on the market this summer after Oakman Group PLC, a restaurant group which had agreed a 35-year lease, went into administration. Councils discussed the building's future at a meeting of the authority's Strategy and Resources Committee on September the 25th, and Tom Hardy, an assistant director of the council, said he hopes to have an agreement for lease in place probably next month. He said, "It's been on the market for a couple of months now. We were open to all kinds of offers as long as they stacked up. Clearly, something that complements the leisure and sports offer in the wider estate was going to be preferable, but we were certainly not wedded to that. We've had 4 open days, and there's been considerable interest. The deadline for proposals was last Friday. We're at a very sensitive stage commercially in that process, but I can confirm that we've had 6 offers that we've deemed are worth taking forward, all within the range that we experienced previously. What we need now to do is to do our due diligence on those. We've started doing some financial checks. There are some points we need to clarify through these proposals, but it is our intention over the coming weeks to do that due diligence and then to whittle down those 6 proposals to a couple of front runners and then see where we get to go with those." The discussion about Batchwood Hall's future was sparked by Conservative councillor Matt Cowley, who suggested it could be considered as a home for a future unitary authority after the District Council and County Council are abolished in the coming years. Councillor Cowley questioned whether the council could end up spending money to improve Batchwood Hall and said, "It's important that we don't do something now for the sake of a short-term income stream in the next couple of years that potentially ends up costing taxpayers a bit more when we come to local government reorganisation. When we've got an asset like this, which is of a significant size, which has a space in it which could potentially be a large council chamber if one were required, it's got parking, it's got land ownership that's in our control, I just thought it was worth us having a discussion about whether or not there are other possible options to commercial use that we might want to explore." Mr. Hardy replied that Batchwood Hall is part of the authority's commercial portfolio and said it was their biggest single income generator from a single asset before Jubilee Square. The Victorian mansion previously housed a nightclub, Club Batchwood, and was used as a vaccination hub during the COVID-19 pandemic. Plans were approved last year to turn it into a luxury hotel and restaurant, with Oakman Group PLC expected to invest millions in a refurbishment. Mr. Hardy said, "We do have a very strong view as officers that as a commercial asset, considering all the alternative options, the best thing that we can do is get that asset back on the market, generating revenue and income, and stop that particular asset falling into further disrepair. We are asking the incoming operator to make the capital investment, which is very similar to the agreement that we had with the previous prospective tenant. I am not currently assuming that we will be putting anything into the capital programme for the council to invest in Batchwood Hall. Doing nothing is not an option. Disposal could be, but there's a loss of revenue income there. Looking at the revenue income over the course of the previous deal, the length of that lease, we're looking at £7 million revenue income, whereas we can only sell things once. Development is another option, but clearly that would require borrowing and the council to be involved." The leader of the Liberal Democrat-run council, Councillor Paul de Court, said the suggestion of holding the hall for potential use as a future council building would require a body to put their money where their mouth is, put that money down, and say we've got a reserve on it, and make sure that the income at least matches what we're going to lose, adding that he can't envisage that happening. Fellow Liberal Democrat Councillor Robert Donald described it as an interesting and innovative idea, but continued, "I don't think the timing, even if that was the right property and the right site, is right. We don't even know yet exactly what unity authority we're going to have, certainly not where they're going to be based. We need to get on with it now and let it get an income before this council is wound up. It's an important asset to this council. We can't be waiting until the unitary situation is all sorted out to let it get an income."
The President of St Albans District Chamber of Commerce, Cheryl Lucette, on St Albans Business Week 2025. This month, the business community is looking forward to the return of St Albans Business Week. Over the years, this event has become a real highlight for our local business community. It's a chance for people to meet, learn from each other, and build strong connections that help businesses grow. Looking back at previous business weeks, we've seen firsthand how valuable these gatherings can be. We've had startups finding their first business partners and established firms discovering fresh ideas. The week has always been about creating opportunities. Many of the conversations started at past events have gone on to spark collaborations, projects, and friendships that are still going strong today. So what's happening this year? This year's programme combines a variety of events from breakfast networking to hands-on training to evening socialising. The week provides opportunities for local business owners to upskill, gain support from peers, share knowledge, and build connections that lead to referrals. It's also a chance to make new friends within the local business community. The full programme is available on the Chamber website, but here are a few highlights. Opening breakfast and panel discussion, a lively breakfast and panel featuring local business leaders sharing their experience and advice. Coffee break networking, the ever popular relaxed monthly networking event. Thriving as an SME. Hosted at Metro Bank, this session explores how small and medium-sized enterprises can make their money work harder. Future Leaders Get Together, an informal networking morning for young professionals, entrepreneurs, and emerging leaders looking to build genuine connections and share ideas. Sales Roundtable, a collaborative session where attendees can share tips and learn from each other about filling pipelines and growing their businesses. After Work Social, drinks and nibbles to finish off the week and reinforce the relationships built. Over the past year, the St Albans District Chamber of Commerce has grown by a third, and Business Week offers members new and old the opportunity to get to know each other. Running a business can be a very lonely and isolating experience for many people. Our events bring people together who know what it's like and help entrepreneurs to build a support network around them, either to find suppliers or to share tips with peers. Companies raise their profile to generate new sales and find clients. Referrals are a very powerful source of leads for any business, and building trust with others puts businesses in the best possible place to secure recommendations. More importantly, these events strengthen the local economy by encouraging us all to work together and create opportunities. Join us. Business Week is open to everyone, long-standing chamber members, new businesses, and anyone curious about meeting others in the local business scene. Some events will be coming for just one event, or to spend the whole week with us. We're looking forward to another great week of conversations, learnings, and celebrating everything that makes St Albans such a brilliant place to do business.
New pothole repair technology has been trialled in parts of Hertfordshire. A Roadmaster spray injection patching machine was used on a rural and residential road in northern Hertfordshire for the first time in the county. Hertfordshire County Council said it is the second trial it has conducted as part of its pledge to improve roads. The council said the Roadmaster differs from other spray injection patches tested in the area because it is operated entirely from the cab, allowing crews to work more efficiently. The machine uses a high-power jet to clean, fill and seal potholes in one process, creating less waste and helping repairs last longer. Stephen Giles Medhurst, councillor responsible for highways at Hertfordshire County Council, said, "We know potholes are one of the biggest frustrations for residents, and we are determined to do more to tackle them. The Roadmaster is a completely different kind of machine that can repair potholes more quickly and with less disruption, all from the safety of the cab. By trialling new approaches like this, we're exploring every option to get better, longer-lasting repairs for Hertfordshire's roads and improve everyday's journey. The Roadmaster's effectiveness and value for money will now be evaluated to determine if it can be used more widely across the county."
Man injured after falling on tracks. A man was taken to hospital after he fell on the tracks at St Albans City Station. Emergency service responded to reports of a person being hit by a train in the early hours of Saturday morning. Two ambulances, a rapid response vehicle, a paramedic car, two basic paramedic cars and East Anglian Air Ambulance were called to Clarence Park in Clarence Road. A spokesperson for the East of England Ambulance Service has since confirmed that one person was transported to St Mary's Hospital by road ambulance with serious injuries. Thameslink told the Hearts Advertiser that a man fell onto the tracks.
St Albans dad to run half marathon in memory of 8-year-old daughter. A St Albans father is running a half marathon in memory of his 8-year-old daughter who passed away just 11 days after being diagnosed with an incurable brain tumour. Andy Smith, an NHS worker from Hearts, will be taking part in this year's Royal Parks Half Marathon, raising money for the Brain Tumour Charity and his daughter, Emily. The 44-year-old said the charity had been a great support to his family since Emily's passing. He will be running alongside Emily's uncle, Johnny, with both wearing a weighted vest, making up Emily's weight throughout, in the hope of carrying her to the finish line. Looking ahead to race day, Andy said, "I just want to make Emily proud. While it's too late for her, the mission is to raise more money, to give more hope to others and provide better outcomes for other families. I'm going to be running with Emily's dad on my vest, and I really love it when I hear people cheering for Emily's dad as I run past." Emily, described by her mum Sarah as the sunshine in every room, showed no obvious symptoms in the lead-up to her diagnosis, no sickness, headaches or eye problems, only mild tiredness that her family had put down to a busy summer. On July the 28th, 2022, Emily woke up with a strange feeling in her arm and began walking with a bit of a limp, though she carried on playing merrily with her older brother, Harry, and could still run around. After ringing 111 for some advice, Emily went for an appointment at the nearest hospital, during which blood tests came back clear. With doctors not overly concerned with Emily's symptoms, it was recommended she be sent home. This was until a final doctor suggested an MRI scan for everyone's peace of mind, which revealed a tumour deep in Emily's brain. Andy describes the days that followed as unbearably traumatic, in which the horror of what was growing inside Emily's brain became apparent. In the early hours of August the 2nd, Emily became incredibly distressed and started violently throwing up as the tumour began to bleed, increasing pressure on her brain until she slipped into a coma. She was subsequently rushed into an emergency surgery, but her parents were given the news that will stay with them forever. It was too late. The tumour had taken hold, and there was nothing more that can be done. Emily was going to pass away. Emily was put on palliative care and never woke up again, dying in her parents' arms on August the 8th, 2022, just 11 days after diagnosis. Reflecting on that night, Andy said, "Me and my wife Sarah were left numb with shock, trauma and disbelief, utterly heartbroken to the point where it physically hurt. Emily was so full of life and now she is dead. She had her whole life ahead of her and now she'll never live it. Our lives will never be the same again. Everyone thinks their own children are special, but Emily really was one of a kind. She was all the good things you can think of and none of the bad." In the years that followed, Andy and Sarah set up Emily's fund within the Brain Tumour Charity. Andy, alongside friends and family, has raised over £100,000 for the charity since 2023, and this includes Emily's brother, Harry, who received a Points of Light award from the Prime Minister, as well as a British Citizen Youth Award at Westminster Palace, as a result of his incredible fundraising efforts. Andy commented, "Losing a child is the worst thing you can ever imagine as a parent. It's still unbelievable to me that she is not here and that this is forever. We've had a lot of grief and bereavement counselling, and it would not be an exaggeration to say that her guidance and support saved us, particularly in those few months after Emily died. I would recommend this to any parent who's lost a child. You have to talk about it. It's important to remember that grief is not a linear process where life gets easier or you move on. I would never want to. I always remind myself that this deep feeling of grief is proportionate to how much love we all have for Emily, so I'll never allow the strength of that grief to fade," he added.
This is a personal view from the Very Reverend Joe Kelly Moore, who's the Dean of St Albans Cathedral. Last week at St Albans Cathedral, we marked the United Nations International Peace Day. Founded in 1981 by UN resolutions, this annual commemoration seeks to inspire not only member nations, but also the whole world to work for peace, end conflict, and foster global cooperation. The theme for 2025 is Act Now for a Peaceful World. As we consider the reality of horrific conflict in our world today, the countless innocent people who've been killed, and the millions of people who are in the midst of cruel suffering, this year's theme could not be more relevant for us all. What we also recognise is the reality of division and increasing prejudice in our own nation. Sadly, that's reflected in the communities of our city and district, where reports of hate crime and acts of violence against property are rising. There can be no doubt that the call to act now for a peaceful world is a vital one, and we all need to hear and take up. Jesus Christ called the world to the way of peace. He also showed the way to live that peace in his human relationships as he reached out to meet the needs of others and called out injustice. Jesus summed up how we could do the same in his bidding that we love our neighbour as ourselves. While national or international decisions taken are beyond the remit of most of us, how we live together in our local community and whether we choose to be peacemakers, it is in our gift every day. Peace begins with you and me. When we seek to better understand one another and so discover our shared humanity and all that unites us, when we respect and value our diversity, celebrating how it enriches us all, when we ensure how we have what they need to flourish, and when together we stand up against injustice and prejudice, then we are builders of the peaceful world we wish for everyone. As the 2025 United Nations International Peace Day reminds us that we are all part of the pathway to peace, may we each be committed and inspired to act now. The world and our neighbours desperately need us too.
Heritage plaque teases new eatery with Spanish theme in St Albans. A heritage plaque revealing the history behind a St Albans City Centre building has also teased its Spanish-themed future. Number 8 George Street, recently home to Ology Brasserie, and number 8 has been vacant for some time, but new signage suggests that it will become Iberos, the Iberian counter. Is thought to be a spin-off of neighbouring business Dillon's at the King's Arms. The St Albans and District Heritage plaque also highlights its history as a butcher's in the 1800s, to becoming a tea rooms until 1921, and then St Albans' first Indian restaurant, the Koh-i-Noor, in 1970. According to reports, the new concept, offering everything the owner loves from the Iberian Peninsula, is due to open this month. A planning application to alter the George Street shopfront was granted conditional permission in July 2025, but plans reveal little or no detail about its new identity, apart from a new signboard and black colour scheme.
Now here's Gilly with the radio listings.
The radio listings for the 7 days beginning 4th of October, compiled by Wendy and read by Gilly. Starting with Saturday, the 4th of October. Today's drama is The Last of England by Neil McKay on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. The real comedy controllers, The Things That Made Us Laugh, brings us favourite moments from the post-war comedy archive. This first of four programmes features stars of variety and the Second World War on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. The Escape Artist tells the story of Rudolf Furber, who with a friend escaped Auschwitz to reveal the truth about the Holocaust on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. Classic FM at the Movies with Jonathan Ross features scores from James Bond films on Classic FM at 7 p.m. Moving on to Sunday the 5th of October. The castaway in Desert Island Discs is artist Angela Harding on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While in an archive edition from 2015, Stephen Fry is the castaway on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Beasts on the Lawn brings us five tales by H.H. Munro, pen name Saki. Set in a gated community for wealthy residents, on Radio 4 Extra at 8:50 a.m, 1:50 p.m. and 7:50 p.m. Peanuts at 75 pays tribute to Charles M. Schulz's classic comic strip on its 75th anniversary on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. The Artificial Composer, Music and AI explores the collision of classical music and artificial intelligence on Radio 3 at 7:15 p.m. In Just One Thing with Michael Mosley, this week Michael encourages us to enjoy oily fish on Radio 4 at 7:45 p.m. Kate Adey presents From Our Own Correspondent on Radio 4 at 9:30 p.m. Turning now to those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. A Carnival of Animals explores the remarkable stories of 20 endangered animals in a series of 5-minute programmes, starting today with the orangutan, on Radio 4 at 10:55 a.m. every day. A Spanish Lover is a dramatisation of Joanna Trollope's 1993 novel about twins Frances and Lizzie, whose lives take contrasting paths. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 a.m, 11:30 a.m. and 5:30 p.m, Monday to Friday. The book of the week is Fly, Wild Swans, Jung Chang's sequel to her novel Wild Swans, charting her path from arriving in the UK as a student in 1978 to the present day. Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m. Monday to Friday. In And When Did You Last See Your Father? Blake Morrison reads his tribute to his cantankerous father, a GP from Yorkshire. Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 a.m, 1:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. I Am What I Ate is the first of 5 varied programmes this week, commissioned as part of the Multitrack Fellowship for Audio Producers. In this first programme, Chantal Romaine tries to recreate her mother's traditional Jamaican cooking in multicultural London. Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. each day this week. The composer of the week is Eleanor Alberger, born 1949, on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. The book at bedtime is Helm by Sarah Hall, on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. Here are some individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday the 6th of October. In the series Great Lives, the subject is Oliver Postgate, who created some of the most enduring worlds and best-loved characters in television, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. There's an edition of Just a Minute on Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m., while another panel show, The Kitchen Cabinet, ends its current series on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Historian Mary Beard's series, Being Roman, continues with A Bag of Snails and a Glass of Wine, looking at Pompeii's pub culture. It's on Radio 4 at 11:30 p.m. and the series continues tomorrow and Wednesday at the same times. some suggestions for Tuesday the 7th of October. In history's toughest heroes, actor Ray Winston charts the stories of 20th century adventurers, starting this week with the Danish explorer, anthropologist and author Peter Frøyken. Radio 4 at 3 p.m. In Ways of Not Seeing, blind writer Joseph Rizzo-Naudi explores how new approaches to describing art can bring galleries and museums to life for everyone on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. In WhatsApp Docs this week, Drs. Chris and Zan van Tulleken examine how nature benefits mental and physical health and how to make the most of it, even in urban environments. Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Peter White brings us his regular programme In Touch, with news and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. Moving on to Wednesday, 8th of October. In File on 4 Investigates, reporter Chris Marston spends time with the Youth Justice Service in Swindon to find out how it rehabilitates young offenders and asks if the success of the youth system could help address overcrowding in adult prisons. Radio 4 at 11 a.m. There's Vintage Comedy with an episode of Hancock's Half Hour from 1958 on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. The literary quiz, The Right Stuff, starts a new series today at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. Choral Evensong comes from St. Peter, Bolton Lemoore's, on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. In the Life Scientific, materials scientist Eleanor Schofield looks at the challenges of studying and protecting ancient wooden warships and the enlightening process of conserving the Mary Rose, on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Then on Thursday the 9th of October, in the Landscapes of Don McCullin, the celebrated photojournalist discusses how, after 60 years covering wars and tragedies, he found his salvation in the Somerset landscape, on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. In This Cultural Life, composer Thomas Addis reflects on his inspirations and discusses the formative influence of regularly attending the ENO. That's on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. Dead Rellies is the third of four plays written for Maureen Lipman in the series A Month of Maureen, on Radio 4 Extra at 8 a.m, 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. A new series of ramblings begins this week, with comic Mark Steele joining Claire Balding for a walk around Hambleton Peninsula in Rutland, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. BBC Inside Science is on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Radical with Amal Rajan offers his take on the week's news on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And so to Friday, 10th of October. The series Soul Music today brings us responses to Nessun Dorma from Puccini's opera Turandot, with contributors including Pavarotti's daughter, Christina, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Siblings is the first episode of The Betrayed, a dark five-part drama set in Ireland. Louise, a senior detective, is forced to choose between her wayward brother Frank and the rule of law, on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. In the series Short Works, Ada Player reads The Victim, a detective comedy, on Radio 4 at 3:45 p.m. The comedy panel show, The News Quiz, continues its run on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Any questions, from York St John University is on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Enjoy your listening week.
And now another article from TNF Soundings. Could an app help reduce eye strain?
Hello, this is Nikki with an article written by Fiona entitled Could an app from Ukraine reduce eye strain? Is our increasing use of mobile phones, laptops and other screens affecting our vision, causing eye strain and physical discomfort? If this is something which concerns you, the work of a startup group in Odessa, Ukraine, may be of interest. Many people worry that viewing a screen often and for long periods can damage their eyes, but according to the College of Optometrists in London, there is no evidence of this. The Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, agrees, stating that you can't harm your eyes by using a computer. They say computers don't cause permanent changes to your eyes or make eye conditions that you may have any worse. But some people remain worried that the blue light emitted by screens is harmful. On the positive side, both the RNIB and the Macular Society agree that inside the human eye, the lens filters out a lot of the light before it reaches the light-sensitive cells of the retina, so the exposure is much reduced. However, all agree that eye strain is common after heavy screen use. WebMD, an American corporation which publishes online news and information about human health and well-being, explains that eye strain is a common condition. It's not unusual to experience eye strain after spending a long time reading, looking at a computer, tablet or smartphone, or even driving. This means after heavy screen time, your eyes start to feel tired or sore, itchy or blurred. You may also develop a sore neck and shoulders. Most cases of eye strain are temporary and disappear after you've taken a break and rested your eyes. The good news is that in cases where eye strain is bothering you, there are easy exercises you can do to help relieve it. That's where a group of technicians and ophthalmologists in Ukraine have stepped in to help. They have developed an app which combines therapeutic exercises and games, making the process of eye strain both simple and fun. The Hillel Computer School in Odessa, a port city in Ukraine, is hosting the work, which is aimed at office workers, programmers, children and teenagers, and people who notice a decrease in vision. A year and a half ago, ophthalmologist Alexander Atmanov came up with the idea of creating a useful service that would help gadget users check their eyesight. Now, Alexander and his colleagues are working to improve vision in what they describe as conditions of digital overload, with research showing users spending on average up to 9 hours a day looking at screens. I'm an ophthalmologist working with both adults and children. My experience with mass screening and work at the Institute allowed me to see how widespread vision problems are, as well as the importance of prevention and timely diagnosis, Alexander explained. The initial idea was for mass vision screening in various educational institutions or offices, but later we realised that it was much more effective to implement it via a smartphone, supplementing the functionality with training capabilities and personalised recommendations. Called Roundel, the app is being tested at the moment by early adopters, including ophthalmologists, children at risk of myopia, gamers and office workers. This allows developers to get feedback and improve and personalise the training techniques. The next stage of testing will involve expanding the audience through partnerships with clinics, educational institutions and e-sports teams. This will allow Roundel to be fully adapted to the needs of individual users. Co-founder of Roundel, Igor Romanenko, is responsible for operational management and communications. He said, "Next steps in the development of the project will involve local testing and an initial launch and analysis of results on the Ukrainian market. After successful local testing, entry into the European and US markets is planned. We wish the team all the very best in their work." In the meantime, you may like to check the WebMD website, which has simple exercises for eye strain. If you go to the website, www.webmd.com, Enter the term eye strain in the search box to find the exercises, or use TNF's special shortcut web link, which is tnflink.uk/12k, all lowercase. That's tnflink.uk/12k.
Now, here from TNF Soundings is a list of audio-described programmes available on television, courtesy of our friends at the Wharfdale Talking News.
Now for the audio-described television programmes for Saturday, 4th October to Friday, 10th of October, compiled by Lisa and read by Chris. For an amusing start to Saturday, Channel 4 has three popular comedy series. Everybody Loves Raymond airs at 8:05 a.m, followed by a double bill of Frasier at 9, and two episodes of The Simpsons at 10. Meanwhile, on BBC One, Rick Stein is in Cornwall at 11:30, cooking Cullen Skink, otherwise known as fish stew. Then at 1:30, Charlie Ross presents Bargain Hunt from Shropshire. There's rugby league action on BBC Two at 5:15 p.m. with live coverage and commentary of the Super League playoff semi-final, followed by a documentary, Secrets of the Jurassic Dinosaurs, at 7:40 p.m. It must be autumn, as episode 2 of Strictly is on BBC One at 6:20, and this week things get serious as one couple will be voted out in Sunday's results show. In total contrast, catch the second part of Nine Bodies in a Mexican Morgue at 9:25. I'm guessing there won't be as many sequins as that. BBC One also has Match of the Day at 10:30 with lots of football commentary and analysis. For movie lovers, there's Dune Part 1 on ITV One at 9:15 p.m. Epic sci-fi drama starring Timothy Chalamet. Channel 4 is showing period spy adventure The King's Man at 9 p.m. starring Ralph Fiennes, followed by Salt, an action thriller starring Angelina Jolie at 11:40 p.m. Now for Sunday. Daytime options are a little thin on the ground, but BBC Two has the ever-reliable Nadia Hussein on her British food adventure at 11:30 a.m. this week, visiting the home counties. Staying with BBC Two, there's a classic western to enjoy at 3:50 p.m. with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Catch Strictly Come Dancing the Results Show at 7:15 on BBC One. And at 9:05 p.m, find out who wins the Battle of Hastings in King and Conqueror, the final part of the historical drama starring James Norton. BBC Two has a travel-themed evening starting at 7:20 with Eva Longoria searching for Spain, in which the actor continues her cultural journey in Andalusia, followed by Pilgrimage, The Road to the Scottish Isles at 8 p.m. and a brand new series at 9, Rob Brydon's Honky Tonk Road Trip, in which the actor and comic explores the roots of country music in the American South. Over on ITV One, Vernon Kay presents M&S, Dress the Nation at 6:55, followed by Beat the Chasers at 8 p.m, the popular quiz hosted by Bradley Walsh. Then there's a new crime drama at 9, when Saran Jones and Jodie Whittaker star in Frauds. Channel 4 has documentary Educating Yorkshire at 8 p.m, in which newly qualified maths teacher Mr. Geary deals with some challenging students. Turning now to this week's soap schedule. On Monday, it's EastEnders at 7:30 p.m. on BBC One, and Emmerdale and Corrie on ITV One at 7:30 and 8 p.m. respectively. Tuesday has EastEnders at 7:30 p.m. and Emmerdale at 7:30 p.m., Wednesday, it's EastEnders at 7:30pm with Emmerdale and Corrie at 7:30 and 8pm. Thursday is EastEnders at 7:30. Friday, it's Emmerdale at 7:30 and Corrie at 8pm. Moving on to Monday the 6th of October. Daytime schedules feature Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30am on BBC One, and later at 2:30pm catch Amanda and Alan's Italian Job, in which the duo renovate two different bathrooms, followed by a new series of The Repair Shop at 3:45pm. The evening highlight on BBC One is part two of Blue Lights at 9pm, whilst over on BBC Two, Jim Al-Khalili continues his investigation into the evolution of our brains in the Horizon documentary Secrets of the Brain, also at 9pm. This is followed by Kunk on Earth at 10pm, in which Philomena Kunk explores the origins of two of the world's great religions. Catch episode 2 of Frauds on ITV1 at 9pm, or over on Channel 4, Joe Wicks is Licensed to Kill at 8pm, in which he carries out a provocative stunt designed to convince the government to change food laws for good. Staying with Channel 4, Social Media Monsters is a new series which airs at 10pm, examining serious crimes where social media has played a significant role. And on to Tuesday. A classic daytime double bill on BBC One with Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30am, followed by Bargain Hunt at 12:15pm. In similar vein, David Dickinson presents Dickinson's Real Deal at 2pm. This week the team are in Preston. BBC One's evening offering includes Stacey and Joe at 8pm. How will Stacey fare at the BAFTAs? Followed by popular school drama Waterloo Road, now in its 16th series at 9pm. It's all round to Nigella's on BBC Two at 7pm for Nigella at My Table as she serves up herby lamb and garlicky potatoes with feta and oregano. Then at 8pm in Digging for Britain, Alice Roberts investigates an intriguing discovery in an Oxfordshire quarry. Dear Old Alan Titchmarsh returns on ITV1 at 8pm in Love Your Garden. The team head to Leicestershire to surprise 96-year-old Gordon with a stunning garden transformation. Let's hope it's a pleasant surprise. Cozy viewing continues on Channel 4 at 8 when it's Pastry Week on The Great British Bake Off. Noel Fielding and Alison Hammond lead the bakers through savoury plats and gala pies. Then things get a little more adventurous at 9:15 in a new series of Worlds Apart. Six young Brits who have never travelled alone are paired up with six pensioners who thought they'd never travel again. It's Wednesday with yet more Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30 on BBC One, and an extra dose of David Dickinson at 2pm on ITV One. The Repair Shop is back on BBC One at 8pm when former children's TV presenter Jenny Hanley brings in a threadbare stuffed monkey with a royal connection, followed by the much heralded new series of Celebrity Traitors at 9pm when Claudia Winkleman greets a group of celebrities as they arrive in the Scottish Highlands to play the game of backstabbing and detection. Then there's comedy film drama at 10:15, when Amy Lou Wood stars in Film Club. Over on BBC Two at 7:30pm, it's Jules and Greg's Wild Swim, followed by Tropic of Cancer with Simon Reeve at 8pm, when the adventurer embarks on a journey round the northern border of the tropics. Stay with BBC Two for Britain's nuclear bomb scandal at 9pm, an investigation into the devastating effects of the UK government's post-war nuclear test programme in Australia and the South Pacific during the 1950s and 60s. The hack continues over on ITV1 at 9 p.m. when Nick must form new alliances as he protects his newspaper from a Fleet Street backlash. Toby Johns stars. Channel 4 has Britain's Most Expensive Homes at 10 p.m, featuring a house on North London's Billionaire Row. Now for Thursday. Amanda Holden and Alan Carr are let loose again at 2:30 p.m. on BBC One in Amanda and Alan's Italian Job. This time they're trying to renovate a 17th century kitchen. BBC One's evening schedule offers Dragon's Den at 8 p.m, including a prehistoric pitch for educational dinosaurs, followed by part two of the Celebrity Traitors at 9 p.m. International football dominates BBC Two and ITV One with live coverage and commentary of Scotland versus Greece at 7:30 p.m. on BBC Two, whilst ITV One has England versus Wales at 7 p.m. Film fans might prefer to stay up for Batman Begins at 10:50 on ITV One, an action fantasy starring Christian Bale as Batman, Bruce Wayne. There's a bit more variety over on Channel 4, who offer George Clark's Homes in the Wild at 8 p.m, in which the architect visits remote Rakino Island off New Zealand's Hauraki Gulf. This is followed at 9 by the reliably entertaining Taskmaster, where the fragile bonds between the celebrity contestants are starting to fray. Night owls might enjoy Gogglebox at 11:20 p.m. when armchair critics share their opinions on what they have been watching this week. And finally, it's Friday, and Homes Under the Hammer visits Kent and Suffolk at 11:30 on BBC One, while Sonali Shah escapes to the country at 2:45 to meet a couple who have dreamed of owning a property in rural Wales. In between, you can catch Sister Boniface investigating a murder at a radio station in Sister Boniface Mysteries at 2 p.m. Lorna Watson stars as the sleuthing nun. BBC One evening highlights include DIY SOS at 8 p.m. when Nick Knowles and the team transform a terraced house in South Wales. At 9:30 p.m, Alan Partridge continues his quest to fix the nation in How Are You? It's Alan. There's more international football over on BBC Two at 7:30 p.m, with live coverage and commentary as Northern Ireland take on group leaders Slovakia at Windsor Park, followed by the gentle wit and wisdom of Bob and Paul in Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing at 10 p.m. This week, the duo visit Loch Ness in search of the legendary monster. ITV One has part two of crime drama Borderline at 9 p.m. Detectives Boyd and Reagan investigate the discovery of a body on a Northern Ireland beach. Light Affair on Channel 4 with The Great British Bake Off and Extra Slice. Joe Brand and Tom Allen digest Pastry Week, followed by Gogglebox at 9 p.m. with more armchair criticism. Then there's Friday Night Comedy with the final episode of offbeat sketch show Mitchell and Webb Are Not Helping at 10 p.m. Rounding off the evening with Greg Davis as the reliably amusing comedian takes to the stage at the Lowry in Salford. And that concludes this week's AD TV listings. Hopefully there is something here for everyone.
Another edition of In Concert Now. David Ireson talks to Jill Burridge about music events upcoming in our area.
Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and I'm joined in the studio, as usual, by David Arson.
Hello.
And here we go with another season of musical events in and around St Albans, Harpenden, Potter's Bar, you name it, we might have it.
Indeed.
We're a little thin on the ground this time, aren't we, in terms of music?
Yes, early in the season.
It is, but it will all get going. We've got sort of four major events happening in September and October. So let's start at the end of September, the 27th on Saturday, the 27th of September. Amadeus are performing at St Saviour's Church on Sandpit Lane.
They are, and it's a celebration concert. They're 50 years old this year.
Ah.
Amadeus was founded by Keith Swanick and the clarinetist Robina Nicholson in 1975. They've only had two principal conductors. Keith Swanick led them for the first 10 years, and then Simon Thompson has conducted them from 1989 to 2017, since when they have had guest conductors. They've worked with eminent soloists over the years: Alexander Bailey, cello; David Pyatt, horn; and Andrew Watkinson, violin. He's the leader of the Endelian Quartet, and given opportunities to many young musicians. They've collaborated with various choirs, among them Carillon, the Harding Choir, St Albans Chamber Choir, and Beaumont School. The orchestra numbers around 40, that's playing strength, and there are three founder members still playing: Colin Beek, bassoon; Anita Beek, his wife, plays the violin; and Roger Neighbour, violin. Asked for highlights of his time as conductor, Simon Thompson said that it would be invidious to pick out individual events, and said that the highlight for him was the consistently high standard of playing that the group has managed to achieve over the years, and I personally can wholeheartedly endorse that. They give their concerts in either St Peter's or St Saviour's, and this one is in St Saviour's. They will start the programme with Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture. It was inspired by one of his visits to the British Isles, in particular to the island of Staffa, with its basalt sea cave known as Fingal's Cave, in 1829. It was reported that the composer immediately jotted down the opening theme on first seeing the island, and he called it To the Lonely Island, zur einsamen Insel. But when it was published by Boosey and Hawkes in 1834, they called it Fingal's Cave, and the title seems to have stuck. According to legend, the cave is the site of what was once the royal castle of Fionn na Gael. Mendelssohn dedicated it to Frederick William IV of Prussia, and Brahms, no less, said of it, "I would gladly give all I have written to have composed something like the Hebrides Overture." So he was a fan. So here's the beginning of the piece, which I'm sure you'll recognise. It starts gently, builds up to a storm in the middle, and finishes quietly with a return of the opening theme.
Rather like the idea of the title of The Lonely Island, personally.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, nice.
Very evocative.
Yeah. And then they move on to a Bach Brandenburg. Bach wrote six Brandenburg concertos, and they get their name because they were dedicated to the Margrave of Brandenburg. Bach wrote a sickeningly sycophantic dedication to the Margrave, really an obsequious piece of writing, as if the Margrave, who we refer to as Your Highness, that was almost God, and Bach merely a humble and talentless servant. And we know the six Brandenburg concertos are actually evidence of Bach's genius, not talentless. Anyway,
totally.
They're playing the fourth Brandenburg concerto, and it's scored for violin and two flutes, and the three soloists are all past or present members of Amadeus. Here's the start of the concerto.
Again, a well-known tune.
Indeed. Another member of Amadeus, the oboist and BBC presenter Sarah Devenald, will then direct Mozart's Serenade for Winds in C minor. Written for two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons and two horns, it has been described as a curiously sombre and powerful work, which often conveys a mood of dramatic intensity. It's unusual in that it has four movements rather than five, which is the usual for a serenade, and three of them are in minor keys. And usually serenades are light and cheerful. Mozart later used a lot of the material in one of his string quartets. And the concert culminates with Simon Thompson conducting Beethoven's Fourth Symphony. Now, this was overshadowed, unfortunately, by the Eroica, which was number three, and the Fifth Symphony, which is very well known. It is light and cheerful and looks back in Haydn's direction rather than forward to the innovations that Beethoven made with his later symphonies. Berlioz, Schumann and Mendelssohn all admired the symphony, and Mendelssohn for some time owned the original score and programmed it several times when he was in Berlin. In the third movement, the Scherzo, originally marked Allegretto Molto at Vivace, very quick and lively, Beethoven crossed out Molto, as his metronome marking is almost impossible to play. A note on this movement says, Beethoven forsook the spirit of the minuet of his predecessors, increased its speed, broke through its formal antiquated mould, and out of a mere dance tune, produced a Scherzo, which in Italian, of course, means jest or joke. Here's the start of the third movement of Beethoven's Fourth Symphony, the Scherzo.
Wonderful. So that's the lineup for Saturday, the 27th of September, when Amadeus celebrate their 50th anniversary. And the concert will be performed at St. Saviour's Church on Sandpit Lane in St. Albans, starting at 7:30. And then running from Thursday, the 8th of October, until Sunday, the 11th of October, over in Hatfield, the Hatfield Music Festival takes place actually in Hatfield House.
Yes.
It's quite a thing. Every year, isn't it?
Yes,
it's over
it is.
10 years old now. And yes.
A lot of concerts in the Marble Hall, which is a wonderful, wonderful room.
Oh, it's sort of worth going because the venue, you know, that Marble Hall is gorgeous.
Yes.
And these acoustics are brilliant there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
So there's a huge programme, basically, with concerts in the morning, the afternoon, late afternoon, as well as the evening. And performers, Guy Johnston, the world-renowned cellist, features very large in...
Yes, he's the musical director.
He is the musical director of it. And I think one of your favourite violinists
is performing. Rachel Poggio is playing. She's my favourite Baroque violinist. He's wonderful. She's playing on Friday night. And on Saturday night, there is a part one of The Messiah. So another popular concert.
Yes. So it's worth looking up. The whole programme for the Hatfield Music Festival is online. They've got a good website there. So if you are interested in going over to Hatfield, those concerts take place October the 8th until Sunday, October the 11th. And then we're heading over to Potter's Bar for the next concert on Saturday the 11th of October. St Mary's Church in Potter's Bar is hosting the Hearts Philharmonia.
Yes, and they're playing one rather unusual work, a concerto for alto saxophone by Ronald Binge. The saxophone doesn't figure much in classical music, but of course it was only invented by Adolf Sax in the early 1840s. So composers such as Debussy use it quite a bit. It's a pity it's not used more. I think you'll agree with me if we play you the start of the last movement of the concerto. So here's the last movement of Ronald Binge's Concerto for Alto Saxophone. Thank you.
I love that. It's just got such movement in it, hasn't it?
Good.
You're right. Yeah. I mean, it's such a neglected, well, not neglected, but it doesn't feature a lot in classical music, does it? Except for one of the performers and promoters of the instrument is Jess Gillam.
Who does
wonderful concerts. Yes. And she's also does a regular programme on Radio 3.
Indeed.
On a Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock.
Yes.
And she is a brilliant saxophonist,
isn't she? Yes, she is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's largely been taken over by the jazz world, which is a pity. I mean, everybody's familiar with banks of saxes playing jazz, big band jazz. But actually, as a solo instrument, it's wonderful.
And the concert also includes a piece by Elgar, I think.
Yes, yes. Elgar's Enigma Variations is deservedly popular, particularly the variation Nimrod. It is a set of 14 variations. The story goes that after a tiring day's teaching, Elgar sat down at the piano and played a tune which caught his wife's attention, and he began to improvise on it in styles which reflected the character of some of his friends and a dog. The organist of Hereford Cathedral, George Robertson Sinclair, had a bulldog named Dan, which on one occasion fell into the River Wye, paddled upstream, and gave a rejoicing bark on reaching dry land. And Sinclair challenged Elgar to set it to music, which he did. It's one of the 14 variations.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's brilliant.
It was first heard at the Three Choirs Festival in Worcester Cathedral on September the 13th, 1899. And here is the theme on which all the variations were based.
And, of course, Nimrod is the one that always features at the Service of Remembrance on November the 11th, isn't it? Lovely. Yeah. OK, so that's the lineup on Saturday the 11th of October. Hearts Philharmonia performing at St Mary's Church in Potter's Bar, 7:30 is the start for that one. And then the following Sunday, which is the 18th, back in St Albans for this one, and back at St Saviour's Church for St Albans Chamber Choir.
Yes, they're giving a concert which includes the Cantus Missae by Joseph Rheinberger, John Taverner's Hymn to the Mother of God and Song for Athene, James Macmillan's Vidi Aquam, a piece for solo violin by Richard Barnard called Grasmere, played by Jenny Wigram, and Thomas Tallis's great 40-part motet Speminalium. Wow. So it's a veritable feast of choral music, both ancient and modern. The Rheinberger Mass is spread throughout the concert, and the John Taverner pieces have his trademark Greek Orthodox flavour. Song for Athene, May Flights of Angels Bear Thee to Thy Rest, was famously sung at Princess Diana's funeral in Westminster Abbey. Hymn to the Mother of God is a similarly atmospheric piece. And they finish this concert with Thomas Tallis's Speminalium, which is an amazing experience for the audience if the choir surrounds them, which is like that the last time I heard it. The choir is divided into 8 groups of 5 voices each. Tallis possibly wrote it as a riposte to Alessandro Striggio, an Italian who had produced a mass in 40 parts and a motet, Ecce Beatum Lucem. Theories have been advanced that he wrote it for the Duke of Norfolk in 1572 for performance at Nonsuch Palace, or that it was written to celebrate Queen Elizabeth's 40th birthday. Scholars can and do argue about it, but as far as I'm concerned, the reason for its composition is secondary to the fact that it exists and has survived. It's a wonderful sound, and here's the beginning of it.
Builds and builds, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, it must be amazing to perform.
There is one magic moment in the middle where everybody stops together and starts again on a sort of apparently a totally unrelated key to the word respice. It's a wonderful piece.
Wow, wonderful piece. It's certainly worth going to hear that. Sounds a lovely programme.
Yes.
So that's the concert on Sunday, the 18th of October at St Saviour's Church. St Albans Chamber Choir are performing, and the concert starts at 5 p.m. Actually, yeah. I think that's a very good time for a concert to start. You then finish in time for some supper.
Indeed, yes.
Good. Lovely. Yes. Well, thank you very much, David, for that lineup
Can I just add a little?
Yes.
I'll just give a plug to the St Peter's lunchtime concerts. They're every Wednesday lunchtime, October the 8th, 15th, 22nd and 29th.
And so they're all the concerts are at St Peter's Church?
They are, all at 1 o'clock.
All at 1 o'clock. Actually, they've got a lovely lineup because they've got Sandringham School of Performing, yep. Beaumont School of Performing, and yep. having talked about the saxophone, the one on October the 29th features Samuel Bedard on saxophone.
He does.
And Joe Foote on piano.
Yes.
So if you're in the market shopping on a Wednesday, you could head finish your visit with a concert at St Peter's Church at 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, thank you again for going through the musical events for September and October. And we'll be back ere long with the next in the season.
Indeed we will.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Now another article from TNF Soundings.
It's Liz here from East Kilbride, and I'm ready to start telling you about the wonderful, wonderful, talented Lucille Ball. So where do I begin? Well, if I tell you that in today's wee chat, I'm going to mention Star Trek and Mission Impossible, that will perhaps lead you to think, well, this is worth listening to. Lucille Ball. Born in 1911. Now, she had a very, shall we say, varied and difficult childhood. Her father was an engineer for the Bell Telephone Company, and he seems to have been a hard-working and decent man. But sadly, he passed away from typhoid fever when Lucille was only 3 years old. This was a great shock and a trauma for the family. And there began many years where she was sent to difficult and different members of the family. The first crowd of grandparents seemed to have been lovely folk who lived very close to an amusement park, one of these holiday resorts, like the kind of resort that features in the film Dirty Dancing. And here we, Lucille, saw the dancers and the entertainers and the stage and the vaudeville acts. So who knows what impact that perhaps had on her. But then her mum remarried, and the next set of grandparents were a very, very strict and austere couple. They only allowed one mirror in the house in case of vanity. And when Lucille was spotted looking at herself, the grandparents were very, very annoyed. She always, it seems, wanted to be a dancer and go on the stage. And although they didn't have much in the way of money, her mum and the grandparents decided, let's give the girl a chance. And she was sent out to a school for dramatic arts in New York. Betty Davis was a pupil there at the same time. It wasn't just to give her a chance to be on the stage, because at the age of 15, our Lucille had started dating, and she was dating a most unsuitable guy called Johnny DeVita, a 21-year-old local hoodlum. So her mum decided, put the girl on the stage and put away all that nonsense. The school did not really nurture her talent. In many ways, they really tried to drain it out of her. But she soldiered on. And that's a key aspect of Lucille Ball's personality. This girl was not an instant success. Many, many years of rejection. Many years of auditions. But she kept going. She dropped the unsuitable boyfriend, by the way. And in these many years, gaining experience and stagecraft, often in the chorus of bigger events, bigger shows, she met some of her lifelong friends, who, by the way, were having much more success than her. Among them were Katharine Hepburn and Ginger Rogers. So we're moving into the 1940s now. She's beginning to be respected and, in fact, booked for regular performances, not your top movies. Rather unkindly, she acquired the nickname of the Queen of the B-movies. And then, moving on to the post-war boom years in America, the great innovations are coming in. Radio still has a big hold in family homes, but there's the beginning of TV, as well as the ongoing wish to be a movie star. In the post-war years, our Lucille established herself as a very successful radio artist. And then she met a charismatic, handsome Cuban band leader called Desi Arnaz. She liked him very much. She wanted to be with him very much. And even from their early married years, Desi, shall we say, had an eye for other women. So Lucille, ever the thinker, realised one way of keeping Desi on a short lease would be to have him in her shows. So she had him in the radio shows, and her role was as a zany housewife, and TV came knocking, and she said, well, I'll do it, but Desi needs to play my husband in the TV version as well. The TV executives were rather concerned. Would America in the 1950s accept a married couple of a redhead and a Cuban? In fact, the public loved the Lucy Show, which became a huge phenomenon, really, in these days before the many channels and these days before streaming. I Love Lucy was a hugely successful show year after year, the big attraction on CBS, the zany housewife who landed in all sorts of scrapes, trying to do her best, but not always succeeding very well. During these years, I think perhaps the reality of the marriage was not what the TV audiences saw. But they stuck together, in part, I think, because they both had very good business brains. And they thought, well, what can we do here? Let's do a deal with some of these TV moguls. Let's offer to pay for a better quality 35mm film, which will make our shows look much more glossy, much more successful, and we'll keep the rights to our shows. And of course, when the shows became a huge, huge success, they were making the big money at the time and even more in the future. Because when they bought back the rights, Desi and Lucille gained a huge amount of money. And in that way, they were a very successful partnership financially. Shall we say the marriage was a bit roller coastery? She finally divorced him in 1960. And when that divorce was finalised, she went ahead and bought him out of the share of the TV company. The TV company, the original name, was their two names put together, Desilu Productions. And that became Lucille Ball's very own entertainment company. She was the first woman to head up such an entertainment company, and she had a very good brain for finding talent. And here's where I'm introducing some of these shows. The ideas for both Star Trek, the original motion picture, and Mission Impossible, way many years before Tom Cruise, were put past the woman executive, Lucille Ball. The executives underestimated our Lucille. She saw they had the potential, especially for the younger markets coming in America, and she gave the green light to these two hugely important shows that not only became later cinema franchises, but in many ways set the standard for what could be done in TV. She was adamant everything had to be as good as possible, and she introduced lots of innovations, like having a cinema and a studio audience right there as a show was recorded, which was especially innovative when you thought of TV comedy shows. Going on to her 50s as a woman on her own, she continued to be a very important person in the American media. And then a dark episode, because in America in the mid-50s, some people in the media were suspected of being communists. The House Un-American Activities Committee unearthed a bit of paper that said that Lucille, as a 24-year-old, had actually hosted a meeting of the Communist Party in her house. She reported to the committee that this was only because she dearly loved her socialist grandfather and had joined the Communist Party at his insistence. Whether this swung it in her favour or not, I think the words of Desi and onto the TV screen probably had an impact. He stepped forward at the, before one of the shows was being recorded and said, "Now look, folks, to settle what our Lucy is about, the only thing red, as in communist, the only thing red about Lucy is her hair, and even that is not legitimate." She continued to be a superstar. In her later years, mixing and attending some of the great Hollywood events, the great Hollywood extravaganzas. In her later life, she appeared on stamps, and her local town decided to make a statue for Lucille. The statue was opened up, and the statue was deemed scary, terrible, dreadful. The council were so shocked, they decided to make another statue. And by the time it was completed, the so-called Scary Lucy statue had become quite a tourist attraction. So if you go to Jamestown, New York these days, you can join the many busloads who visit the two statues, which are in the town square, the Scary Lucy one and 25 yards away from it, the one that they think is a much better one. I think perhaps I better end now. I hope I've given you an idea of the wonder, the phenomenon of Lucille Ball. And perhaps I should end with one of her sayings. I hope you like it. Lucille said, "The secret of staying young is to live honestly, eat slowly, and lie about your age." Well, there you are, folks. Lucille Ball, a real force of nature.
The extraordinary story of Lucille Ball. Now, here's Rob Pearman with news of a very special birthday.
Towards the end of 2024 and at the beginning of 2025, we celebrated the 100th birthdays of two of our listeners. First, Mrs. Sheila Langley, and then Anthony Beaumont Jones. And in May of this year, with the help of my colleague Mark, I had the pleasure of interviewing another of our listeners. I went to see her to ask about her past life, but also her recent visit to Buckingham Palace to take tea with the King and Queen. That visit to Buckingham Palace was because she was invited there to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the Victory in Europe, also known, of course, as VE Day, and I'm sure we'll remember it, not that long ago. Now, why are we talking about this third listener? Because this month, on Friday, October the 3rd, Mrs. Olga Hopkins became our third listener in 12 months to reach her 100th birthday. Not long after we met her to record that interview, Mrs. Hopkins was invited to visit Vareham School, quite close to where she still lives. And it was also where she and her husband, Alan, had been senior teachers for many years. During her visit, she met some of today's students, and she was also invited to open a special study area that's been named in her honour. So please join me now in raising a glass, a cup of tea, or whatever is close at hand, to wish Mrs. Olga Hopkins a happy birthday and congratulations on achieving her own personal centenary. Happy birthday, and may you enjoy many more such days. And to remind Olga of one of the important parts in her past life, her years during the war when she was a radio mechanic on bomber planes, 1943 right through till 1947, here's an extract from the RAF March.
At the beginning of the programme, I played True Companion by Donald Fagen. Donald J. Fagen was born January the 10th, 1948. He's an American singer-songwriter and musician who is the co-founder, lead singer, co-songwriter and keyboard player of the rock band Steely Dan, formed in the early 1970s with musical partner Walter Becker. In addition to his work with Steely Dan, Fagen has released four solo albums, beginning with The Nightfly in 1982, which was nominated for seven Grammys. In 2001, Fagen was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of Steely Dan. Following Becker's death in 2017, Fagen continues to tour using the band name, albeit reluctantly. He was born in Passaic, New Jersey, on January the 10th, 1948, to Jewish parents, descendants of immigrants from Russia, Latvia, and Austria, who had arrived in the USA in the early years of the 20th century. His father was Joseph Jerry Fagen, an accountant, and his mother, Eleanor, née Rosenberg, a homemaker who had been a swing singer in upstate New York's Catskill Mountains from childhood through her teens. His family moved to Fair Lawn, a small town near Passaic. When he was 10 years old, he moved with his parents and younger sister to Kendall Park, a newly constructed suburban section of South Brunswick, New Jersey. The transition upset him. He detested living in the suburbs. He later recalled that it was like a prison. I think I lost faith in my parents' judgment. It was probably the first time I realized I had my own view of life. His life in Kendall Park, including his teenage love of late-night radio, inspired his later album, The Nightfly. He became interested in rock and rhythm and blues in the late 1950s. The first record he bought was Reelin' and Rockin' by Chuck Berry. At age 11, his cousin, Barbara Cohen, recommended jazz music, and Fagen went to the Newport Jazz Festival, becoming what he called a jazz snob. I lost interest in rock and roll and started developing an antisocial personality. He learned to play the piano and played baritone horn in the high school marching band. And he developed a lifelong fondness for table tennis. In his late teens, he was drawn to soul music, funk, Motown, and Sly and the Family Stone. He has also expressed admiration for the Boswell sisters, Henry Mancini, and Ray Charles. After graduating from South Brunswick High School in 1965, he enrolled at Bard College to study English literature, where he met Walter Becker in a coffee house in 1967. Becker and Fagen attracted a revolving assortment of musicians, including future actor Chevy Chase, to form the bands Leather Canary, the Don Fagen Jazz Trio, and the Bad Rock Band. Fagen described his college bands as sounding like the Kingsmen performing Frank Zappa material. None of the groups lasted long, but the partnership between Fagen and Becker did. Becker and Fagen began to form Steely Dan in the summer of 1970, responding to a Village Voice ad for a bassist and keyboard player with jazz chops, placed by guitarist Denny Dias. Dias was immediately impressed by the pair's abilities, and especially that they already had a whole stack of original material. Fans of Beat Generation literature, Fagan and Becker named the band after a steam-powered vibrator mentioned in the William S. Burroughs novel Naked Lunch. After the release of their third LP in 1974, the other members left or were fired from the band, which evolved into a studio project headed by Becker and Fagan. 3 years later, they released Gaucho. Their next album was not until 1995, when they released the live album Alive in America. It was followed by the multiple Grammy Award-winning Two Against Nature in 2000, and Steely Dan's most recent album Everything Must Go in 2003. After Becker's death in 2017, Fagan wished to retire the Steely Dan name out of respect for his bandmate and tour under a different name, but promoters advised him against it for commercial reasons. As of 2024, Fagan continues to tour as Steely Dan. After Steely Dan's breakup in 1981, Fagan released his debut solo album, The Nightfly, in October 1982. It was certified platinum for sales of over 1 million copies in the US and reached number 11 on the Billboard Top 200 Albums list. During the rest of the 1980s, Fagan contributed to soundtracks and wrote a column for Premiere magazine. In 1988, he released Century's End from the score to the Michael J. Fox film Bright Lights, Big City. At the close of the decade, he returned to the stage with the New York Rock and Soul Review. In 2013, Fagan published an autobiography entitled Eminent Hipsters. A biography, Nightfly, The Life of Steely Dan's Donald Fagan, by Peter Jones, was published in 2022. Fagan has classified himself as both a self-taught pianist and a self-taught vocalist, although he did spend a few semesters studying formally at Berklee College of Music and took some vocal lessons in the mid-1970s as a precaution after feeling the straining effects of years of touring. As a composer, he has never worked in any definable genre, drawing instead on elements of rock, rhythm and blues, blues, soul, jazz, pop, country, funk, film music, musical theatre, the Great American Songbook, and such classical composers as Bach and Stravinsky. One feature of both Steely Dan's music and Fagan's solo work is the distinctive sound of a chord known as the MU major, in which a major second is inserted into a triad. In 1993, Fagan married songwriter Libby Titus. Although the two attended Bard College at around the same time, they did not become friends until 1987, when they were backstage at a Dr. John concert. On January 4, 2016, Titus sustained injuries after Fagan allegedly shoved her against a marble window frame at their Upper East Side apartment. She co-wrote the song Florida Room on the 1993 album Kamakiriad. Fagan has also performed with his stepdaughter Amy Helm, daughter of Titus and musician Levon Helm. Titus died on October the 13th. Let's listen now to probably his most famous piece, The Nightfly. Skyline.
wish I had a heart of ice, a heart like ice. If you watch your honey to look super swell, you must spring for that little job.
And now some notable events that happened this week in the past, compiled by Bob from Stevenage Talking News. On October the 5th in 2018, a framed work by the graffiti artist Banksy was auctioned at Sotheby's. Girl with Balloon depicts a young girl with her hand extended toward a red, heart-shaped balloon carried away by the wind and has been rated as Britain's favourite artwork. Girl with Balloon started in 2002 as a series of stencil murals around London. The copy sold at Sotheby's reached over £1 million, a record high for the artist. But, moments after the closing bid, the lower half of the artwork began to self-destruct by means of a hidden mechanical paper shredder that Banksy had built into the frame bottom. Banksy confirmed via social media that he was responsible for the shredding and gave the altered piece a new name. Love is in the Bin. Sotheby's released a statement that called it the first artwork in history to have been created live during an auction. Fortunately for her, the woman who won the bidding at the auction decided to go through with the purchase, and Love Is in the Bin was itself sold at Sotheby's for £18 million in 2021. On October the 6th, in 1889, the famous Moulin Rouge opened in Paris. It's a tourist attraction and landmark due to the red windmill on its roof, from which it derives its name. Originally named the Jardin de Paris, it began as an outdoor garden café concert, a place where the music was generally light-hearted and sometimes risqué, or even bawdy, but not particularly political or confrontational. It swiftly became a favoured venue amongst artists, including Toulouse-Lautrec, whose posters and paintings contributed to its rapid and international renown. Moulin Rouge is best known as the birthplace of the modern form of the can-can. Originally introduced as a seductive dance by the courtesans who operated from the site, the can-can dance revue evolved into a form of entertainment in its own right, and led to the introduction of cabarets across Europe. October the 7th, Britain's Secret Service Bureau, the precursor of both MI5 and MI6, began operations in 1909 and was initially staffed by just two officers, an army captain, Vernon Kell, and a Royal Navy commander, Mansfield Cumming. The Bureau was a response to concerns about the role of German spy rings in the arms race prior to World War I. Most of the presumed espionage was a figment of the media and popular imaginations. "Refuse to be served by a German waiter," warned the newspapers. "If your waiter says he is Swiss, ask to see his passport." But a real network of spies working for German naval intelligence was discovered. MI5 is an abbreviation for Military Intelligence Section 5 and is still the popular name for the Security Service, the UK's domestic counterintelligence agency. Its counterpart, the Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6, operates abroad to identify threats to the UK. October the 8th. On October the 8th, 1998, the United States House of Representatives authorized the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. The charges stemmed from a sexual harassment lawsuit filed against Clinton by Paula Jones, during which Clinton gave testimony denying that he had also engaged in a sexual relationship with a White House intern, Monica Lewinsky. This became the catalyst for the president's impeachment. Clinton was eventually acquitted on both counts, as neither received the necessary two-thirds majority vote needed for conviction, and he remained in office. His job approval rating actually rose during the scandal and subsequent impeachment. But, perhaps not surprisingly, his poll numbers with regard to questions of honesty, integrity, and moral character declined. October the 9th. In 1799, the frigate HMS Lutine sank during a storm off the North German coast. She was carrying a large cargo of silver and gold bullion, generally estimated to be worth around £1.2 million. The cargo was insured by Lloyd's of London, which paid the claim in full. The majority of the cargo has never been recovered, but 59 years after she sank, the famous Lutine Bell was salvaged and hung in Lloyd's headquarters in London. The bell is 18 inches in diameter, weighs 106 pounds, and is engraved Saint-Jean, 1779, rather than with the ship's name. No one knows why. Traditionally, the bell was rung when news of an overdue ship arrived, once for the loss of a ship and twice for her safe return. But it has developed a crack, and the traditional practice of ringing news has ended. The last time the bell was rung to tell of a lost ship was in 1979, and the last time to herald the return of an overdue ship was in 1989. The bell also tolls when a member of the royal family dies, and is now rung to commemorate disasters such as 9/11, the Asian tsunami, and the London bombings. It is always rung at the start and end of the 2-minute silence on Armistice Day. October the 10th. In 2019, some women attended a football match to cheer on their team, an apparently everyday event, but this match was being played in Tehran, where women had effectively been banned from stadiums where men are playing since the Islamic Revolution 30 years previously. While lifting the ban seemed to mark a change of attitude to the freedom of women by the Iranian government, Amnesty International called the move a cynical publicity stunt. The change followed the death of a fan who had set herself alight after being arrested for trying to attend a match. More than 3,500 women bought tickets to the World Cup qualifier between Iran and football minnows Cambodia. They were granted access to a special women's-only section of the Azadi Stadium, which has a capacity of about 78,000 people. Finally, October the 11th. In 1521, Pope Leo X granted the title Defender of the Faith to King Henry VIII in recognition of Henry's book, Defense of the Seven Sacraments, which defended the sacred nature of marriage and the supremacy of the Pope as head of the Church. The justification for the gift would prove ironic. 13 years later, Henry declared himself the head of the Church in England after one of Leo's successors refused to annul the king's marriage to Catherine of Aragon. And Henry, of course, famously went on to divorce Catherine and to have 5 more wives. Now here are some famous people who had their birthdays this week, compiled by Lynn. On the 5th of October in 1936, the Czech statesman, author, poet, playwright and dissident Václav Havel was born. He came from a wealthy bourgeois background, and, under communism, this meant he had limited opportunities for education and jobs. However, he rose to prominence as a playwright, using an absurdist style in his plays to criticize the communist system. He became increasingly politically active, founding several dissident initiatives, including the Committee for the Defense of the Unjustly Prosecuted. His activities brought him under the surveillance of the secret police, and he was imprisoned multiple times as a political prisoner, the longest term being 4 years. Havel's Civic Forum Party played a major role in the Velvet Revolution that toppled the communist system in Czechoslovakia in 1989. He assumed the presidency shortly thereafter and was re-elected in a landslide the following year, and then again 4 years later at the time of Slovak independence. He was instrumental in dismantling the Warsaw Pact and the enlargement of NATO membership eastward. Many of his stances and policies were very controversial in his country, and, by the end of his presidency, he enjoyed greater popularity abroad than at home. After his presidency, Havel continued his life as a public intellectual. His political philosophy was one of anti-consumerism, humanitarianism, environmentalism, civil activism, and direct democracy. He received numerous accolades during his lifetime, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Gandhi Peace Prize, and the Ambassador of Conscience Award. He is considered by some to be one of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century. On the 6th of October in 1939, the English broadcaster, author, and parliamentarian Melvin Bragg was born into a working-class family in Cumbria. His parents ran a pub, and, after attending the local grammar school, he was one of a small number of working-class students who was encouraged to go to Oxford University, where he studied modern history. He began his broadcasting career as a trainee at the BBC, working in radio and then television, before moving to London Weekend Television and presenting the arts programme, The South Bank Show, from 1978 to 2010. He has also made many programmes for Radio 4, including Start the Week and In Our Time. Bragg has published numerous autobiographical fiction novels and written television and film screenplays, as well as many non-fiction works, and he has received several awards for his writing. He was appointed to the House of Lords by Tony Blair in 1998 as the life peer Baron Bragg of Wigton in the County of Cumbria, and is an active peer, taking a keen interest in all matters and frequently exercising his right to vote. Bragg sits on many boards of charities and educational and arts institutions. On the 7th of October in 1957, the British ice dancer Jane Torvill was born. She grew up in Nottingham and worked as an insurance clerk for Norwich Union. She became hooked on ice dancing aged 8, following an after-school trip to the local ice rink, and, aged only 14, won the British Pairs Figure Skating Championship in 1971. She paired up with Christopher Dean in 1975, and, after coming fifth in the 1980 Winter Olympics, they both gave up their jobs to focus on skating full-time. Their performance to Ravel's Bolero at the 1984 Winter Olympics is one of the most popular achievements in the history of British sport, and was watched by 24 million people. The pair received 12 perfect marks, and of course the gold medal. Torvill and Dean then turned professional and did not compete in the Olympics again until 1994, when they won the bronze medal. They were also 4-time world and European champions and 7-time British champions. From 2006 to 2025, Tourville has participated in the TV programme and touring show Dancing on Ice as a judge and mentor, and has achieved amazing results with people who have never skated before. On the 8th of October in 1929, the British politician Betty Boothroyd was born. She grew up in Yorkshire, and for 6 years she worked as a dancer in the Tiller Girls troupe. After a foot infection put paid to her dancing career, Boothroyd decided to go into politics and worked as a secretary to Barbara Castle in the 1950s. She was elected to a seat on Hammersmith Borough Council, and after contesting several seats for the Labour Party, was elected as the MP for West Bromwich in 1973. She represented the constituency for 27 years. After holding several positions on government committees, Boothroyd became a deputy speaker to the House of Commons in 1987 and was elected as the speaker in 1992, becoming the first woman to hold the position. She was addressed as Madam, and her signature catchphrase in closing Prime Minister's questions was, "Time's up." She remained the speaker for 8 years and became something of a national institution. She was created a life peer in 2001 with the title of Baroness Boothroyd of Sandwell, and awarded the Order of Merit, as well as being an honorary fellow of several universities. She has 11 portraits in the National Gallery and died at the age of 93. On the 9th of October in 1955, the British athlete Steve Ovett was born. He grew up in Brighton and showed early promise as an athlete, winning the under-15 English schools title at 400 and 800 metres. His first major win was at age 18, setting a new European junior record for the 800 metres. By the time he was 22, he had moved up to the big leagues and was also running in the 1500 metres, again breaking records. In 1978, his rivalry with Sebastian Coe started, and by the 1980 Moscow Olympics, there was great British interest in the pair, with Ovett winning the 800 metres and Coe taking the 1500. The pair regularly broke each other's records over the next few years. Ovett competed at the highest level for another 4 years, still running against Coe, and also Steve Cram, but he was dogged by illness and injury, and did not achieve his previous great form again, retiring in 1991, a year after Sebastian Coe. After retirement, Ovett took up field and track commentary in Canada, and now lives in Australia. He has a statue in Brighton in recognition of his achievements. On the 10th of October in 1946, the English actor Charles Dance was born. He grew up in Plymouth and studied drawing, graphic design and photography. He started his acting career in the Royal Shakespeare Company in the 1970s and has continued to perform with them over the years. After a few small TV roles, his big break was playing Guy Perron in The Jewel in the Crown. He once played a henchman in a James Bond film, but turned down the chance to screen test for the main role. He has starred in over 30 stage productions, over 70 films, and over 70 TV dramas, including Game of Thrones, Bleak House, Foyle's War, Gosford Park, The Imitation Game, and The Crown. His range of roles is incredibly broad, but he is best known for playing intimidating, authoritarian characters and villains. He was awarded an OBE and has won a clutch of Emmys, Screen Actor Guild Awards, and a BAFTA for The Jewel in the Crown. Finally, on the 11th of October in 1844, the American entrepreneur John Henry Heinz was born. He began a food packing business on a small scale in 1869 with a friend, the Heinz and Noble Company, which started by marketing bottled horseradish, soon followed by sauerkraut, vinegar, and pickles. The company went bankrupt in 1875, but the following year Heinz founded another company, F&J Heinz, with his brother and a cousin. The company grew, and in 1888, Heinz bought out his other two partners and reorganized it as the H.J. Heinz Company, the name carried to the present day. The company's slogan, 57 Varieties, was introduced by Heinz in 1896, though by then the company was selling more than 60 different products. He said he chose 5 because it was his lucky number, while 7 was his wife's lucky number. At the time of his death in Pittsburgh at the age of 74, the H.J. Heinz Company had more than 20 food processing plants and owned seed farms and container factories. Heinz baked beans are probably the most popular Heinz product in the UK, and no other country loves them as much as we do. Between 1941 and 1948, the Ministry of Food classified Heinz baked beans as an essential food as part of its wartime rationing system. The Heinz fortune became the basis for the Heinz Foundations, which grant endowments of $90 million annually to support a huge range of causes, including health initiatives, support for veterans, climate projects, and civic participation. And that rounds off this month's edition of News Extra. My thanks to Leslie, Marion, Michelle, and Caroline for reading the news. Thanks also to all at TNF Soundings and Stevenage Talking News for the week in history and famous birthdays. Let me take this opportunity to wish you a safe and peaceful October. Steve will be back next week looking after primary for me, and he returns to News Extra as usual in November. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.